Right now, it's time for my favorite part of the week. Yes, there's no doubt about it. If you know me, you know that food is an important part of my life. And also, the suggestions and information we get from our next show host, which is Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning, and I hope all is well with everybody. Here it's going to be like spring today in Brooklyn. I'm looking forward.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we still have fall leaves clinging to the trees. It's been so warm that here we are in the middle of December, and it looks like it's before Thanksgiving. But moving on, the weather may contribute to my various food cravings, but a few weeks ago, I was craving, when the weather started breaking finally, and it was in the 50s, I started craving a fall treat, a nutmeg cake. And this nutmeg cake has a real good story attached to it. And I decided to go online to see, because somebody told me that it was Armenian. So I went online. Actually, cut to the chase here, my recipe for this nutmeg cake is all over the internet. Sometimes I'm credited for it, and I should be because it's got a great story that I can tell attached to it, and sometimes not. And then there's now a rash of recipes called Armenian nutmeg cake, and I don't doubt that this recipe was originally Armenian, but I got it secondhand from Lori Colwin. Now, Lori Colwin she died very, very young, I have to say, 20 years ago. I'm going to look up the date, actually. But Lori Colwin was a novelist who also wrote a column for Gourmet magazine. Yes, I'm old enough to remember when Gourmet had a heyday in the 80s, I guess. Anyway, Lori wrote this a very well-read column, and that became two books, Home Cooking and More Home Cooking. Now, Lori lived in Cornwall, and I lived in Cornwall, and we had a mutual friend who lived down the road from me, and I heard all about Lori, that she wanted to meet me, and I wanted to meet her, and I don't know, somehow this never really happened until the mutual friend's husband opened a new art studio and they had a studio warming party, and Lori was charged with making the dips. And I got to the party, and I see this woman standing with an enormous pottery, local potter, a pottery bowl full of hummus, and I said, "Oh, Lori Colwin." And we finally met and bonded immediately, and she made very good hummus. And I don't even remember what all else there was, but it's not important. So we wanted to get together in a more, you know, intimate, so to speak, a situation, not at a big art studio warming. And so we called each other, and we had a nice long conversation, and I invited her and her husband and her daughter for dinner, and she said, "Nah, my husband doesn't really like to socialize when he's up here. Why don't we wait till I get back to Manhattan, and we can have lunch?" I said, "Great." And then she died. In her sleep, in her late 40s, and we never had the lunch. A few weeks go by, and the mutual friend comes by my house and says, "I want you to have something that's from Lori. It's a recipe that she gave me." Now, let me say that our mutual friend, I'm not mentioning her name for discretion here, our mutual friend did not cook. I mean, she not only did not cook, she would not cook. She had several children. I'm not sure what they ate, but I know that it was an issue. So, and the husband didn't cook either. He was an artist. He was in the new studio all the time. Anyway, the mutual friend comes by and she said, "This is a recipe that Lori gave to me because she was so embarrassed for me that I couldn't even bake a cookie for my kids. And it's a simple cake recipe. Truth, you know, is I never made it. But she said she would never publish the recipe, that if anybody asked me where the recipe came from, I could say it was an old family recipe. Well, looking at the recipe, which has an inordinate amount of nutmeg, and not only that, but also cinnamon and nutmeg and clove, plus the liquid is yogurt, I'm figuring it's somewhere Middle Eastern-ish. So, but it ends up, it's now on the internet as an Armenian nutmeg cake, and real Armenians are comment on these cakes. My grandmother used to make a cake just like this. I'm so happy to have this recipe because it's like my grandma's. Well, if you look online, you'll find out that there are other versions besides Lori Colwin's version of the nutmeg cake, but I do want to give you Lori's. I made it. I had some friends in for lunch one day. I'm starting to entertain people again a little bit. And I thought this was something. Listen, I was craving it. I could make all kinds of rationalizations how it fit or didn't fit into the menu. It doesn't matter. I wanted to eat this. So the only way to eat it was to make it. It's really interesting cake. You make this, the dry mixture. Bakers will know what I'm talking about. It's you make up the dry mixture and pat half of it, more or less, into the bottom of a springform pan. And when I say pat it, you really are making a bottom crust for a cake that is going to be light. The rest of the dry, you add the spices, and then you stir in an egg and yogurt. And what makes it rise is a little bit of baking soda that is the very last thing. Now, baking soda interacts with anything acidic, and you will immediately get a little rise out of it. Baking powder is something different. It has soda in it, but it's called double acting because the second part doesn't happen until it's heated. Anyway, in this case, there's no. It's only baking soda. So here's the mixture. By the way, a lot of butter. Very good. You don't even have to butter the springform pan, 10-inch springform pan. You could even do it in a 9-inch springform pan if you don't have a 10-inch. You don't have to butter it at all, except maybe the sides, not the bottom, because the pastry, so to speak, is pretty buttery. So, in fact, it's a stick of butter, and you cut the butter into the other dry ingredients, which are 2 cups of flour and 2 cups of dark brown sugar. When I say cut, it's like exactly you are making pastry. I have a pastry blender, which, you know, is a handle with, like, wires, and I like to use it, and it's a good one. Some of them are really chintzy, and the wires bend immediately, but mine has been used for 25 years, and it's still in good shape. But you could use 2 knives. Just take 2 table knives, and holding 1 in each hand, keep cutting, cutting the butter into the flour and sugar mixture. So half of that, well, 2.5 cups of that, measure it out, spread it evenly into the bottom of your pan. If it's a 9-inch pan, this is going to be an awfully thick crust. So I really do recommend a 10-inch pan, a springform, like you use for a cheesecake. But if you have a 9-inch pan, maybe you hold back a half a cup. Use 2 cups of the mixture for the bottom. And then the top gets the spices, which are inordinate. It sounds like way too much, but it's not. 4 teaspoons. A freshly grated nutmeg. My friend who was eating this cake said, well, does it have to be freshly grated, and how do you grate nutmeg? There are a lot of ways to grate nutmeg, and if I had the energy at that moment, I would have gone into my closet. On the top is a box with a collection of nutmeg graters. There are all different ways to grate nutmeg. But if you have a microplane, that works. The fine side of a box grater works. I have a grinder. You actually put the nutmeg into this gizmo. It's like a pepper mill. but it doesn't have a mill at the bottom. It has claws that hold the actual nutmeg in place, and then it shaves off the nutmeg. I like this one, and then it also looks nice on the shelf. So 4 teaspoons of freshly grated nutmeg, 1 teaspoon of ground cinnamon, and 1/4 teaspoon of ground cloves. Don't worry about the cloves. They're minimal but necessary. And if you don't have ground cloves, leave it out. So they're not so necessary. And you mix all that up. This is now the top of the cake. And into that, you stir, beaten together, 1 cup of yogurt and 1 egg. Beat them together in a little cup. Add them to the dry ingredients with 1 teaspoon of baking soda. As you're stirring it in the yogurt, sprinkle that on top and stir it thoroughly in. Pour it into your springform pan and sprinkle on 1/2 cup of coarsely chopped walnuts. I read one of these Armenian recipes this morning, and it called for pistachios. And now that you can buy shelled pistachios, I think I'm going to, and I have some, I think I'm going to try that next time. And there will be a next time. I love this cake. I've been making it for many years. And of course, I always think of Lori and the tragedy. Anyway, and you can, as I say, it's online. My version of it is online. And other versions of and I might even try one of the other versions because I don't always have. By the way, do not use Greek yogurt in this. You have to use plain, normal, whole milk yogurt. So this brings me not to food prices. I don't know. Nobody makes a thing of this on TV, on news, which I'm addicted to, or on radio news, which I also listen to. But inflation is largely generated this time around by increases in, of course, gasoline at the pumps, which everybody notices, and food prices, which, of course, everybody notices. But those two are, in fact, the main generators of the 6.8% inflation that was announced last Friday. And food is way higher than that. I think, and interestingly, food eaten at home, which I think is almost 10% higher than it was last year, is largely generated by meat prices. So if you are doing a meatless day or two of your week, you probably may not have noticed your overall food budget has gone up. Well, yes, fruit and vegetables. You know, since I'm a big fruit and vegetable eater, I noticed that too. But you know, if you stay seasonal, it's not that bad. It really isn't. And meat prices are what's terrifying. So the cheapest meats, and by the way, the biggest increases have been in beef, way more than pork, which is more than chicken. So if you're a chicken eater, my nephew, for instance, hasn't eaten red meat in months, and he says he doesn't really notice he's spending much more on food. Milk and eggs have gone up, yes, but you know, eggs are still pretty inexpensive. What is it? I don't know. What do you pay for a dozen eggs, Marshall? Are you conscious of it?
Because prices have been so crazy. No, I just get what I need to get. And
yeah, well, I did a whole thing on this a couple of years ago. There are too many choices in eggs. If you go to any one of my markets, there are probably, I don't know, at least 5 or 6 different kinds of large eggs, cage-free, brown, organic, I don't know. You know, and the prices vary from $2.99 a dozen, which I think is a very fair price for a dozen of protein powerhouses like eggs. And, you know, we're not afraid of eggs anymore. I'm old enough to remember when there was a time people were afraid of eggs. Thank God we're not afraid of eggs anymore. Anyway, and if you're on a budget, really, eggs are a savior. And even at $3.99 a dozen, What is 12 into 3.99? Is that, it's not even, it's 30 cents. 30-something cents an egg. So if you eliminate beef, you're ahead. And pork, you're ahead. However, there are cuts that are still very affordable. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that because I went to the butcher to buy chicken backs to make chicken broth. It didn't have them that day, and since I was already eager to make broths, I bought all these neck bones, and I boiled them for 6 hours to make what we call these days bone broth, you know, a high collagen, high protein gelled broth. And after 6 hours of simmering, the meat was still delicious. So I, of course, stripped the meat off the bones and did something with the meat. And thinking to myself, well, this is really good meat that I haven't eaten since I don't know when. My mother always sent me to the butcher for neck and tenderloin. In those days, tenderloin meant what we call hanger steak now. Those are two very flavorful cuts. So for ground meat, the kosher butcher anyway sold it for ground meat. Anyway, I decided this week to cook the neck meat as a braise, basically. And I made this for some Mormon family as a cultural experience. I made a whole Jewish dinner, well, luncheon, and with, for me, some key dishes, including what I would call gedämpte Fleisch. Now, I didn't grow up with my grandmother, who was very American, calling it gedämpte Fleisch. She would call it potted beef, potted meat, potted flanken. We would eat flanken. So I go to the butcher to buy flanken, and Bob's favorite way of my potting flanken is sweet and sour. So, but I couldn't find good flanken, and even the bad flanken was so crazy expensive that I said, this is a poor man dish. I'm not going to make this with $15 a pound meat. So I bought the beef neck bones instead, and I potted them. Boy, was that good. I will do that again. And it took 3 hours of simmering. And this is a recipe that is in my book, Jewish Home Cooking, but for sweet and sour flanken. I have revised the recipe because that recipe called for canned tomato sauce, which is, of course, what any Jewish grandma would have used in the 1950s. So I am now updated it, and I used, instead of canned tomato sauce, I used bottled tomato puree, Italian bottled tomato puree. I buy a very good brand. The Muti, I see, is around now, M-U-T-I. I see the supermarkets carry that now. That's a very good brand, too. But I buy a good brand. It's a nice, thick tomato puree, and what I did was I didn't want to stand and brown this meat, which is what I did in Jewish Home Cooking. I put all my neck bones in a roasting pan, and I roasted them at 450 degrees for about 35, 40 minutes, flipping them once, about 20 minutes in, and they got nice and brown. I put them into my casserole pot, top of the stove casserole, although I actually was intending to put it in the oven, which I do frequently with these kind of things, which I still would do, except the oven had something else in it, and I don't want to go into that. But anyway, I did it on top of the stove. So I put it into the pot, a big cast iron enameled pot, and I poured in the tomato puree. I rinse out the bottle with about, let's say, a quarter of the bottle of water. And then I also put into the roasting pan that I use to roast the meat, I also put in about a cup or so of water, and I swish that around. I even put the flame under the pan for a minute or two to really get up any of the brown bits that were, and the fond. I love that word. The French call it fond, F-O-N-D, the fond from the bottom of the pan. and poured that into the casserole. And I did not have enough liquid to cover the casserole, but that was okay. And I simmered the meat, flipping it around a few times, adding water a little bit at a time because it does simmer down. By the way, I did this covered, even or a semi-covered. I had a little top, little bit of jar on a very slow simmer for about 3 hours. And at that point, the meat was not totally tender, but it was coming away from the bones. So I let it come to room temperature, and then I stripped the meat off the bones, discarded the bones. Actually, I rinsed the bones because they had so much flavor clinging to them, and I put that back in the pot, that liquid from rinsed bones, and I put the meat in there with the sauce. And I continued to, when I was ready to serve it, I continued to cook it, reheat it, for at least another half hour until the meat was really melt-in-your-mouth tender. It really is very good meat. And it amazingly, it really keeps its flavor, even with all that cooking. And it has a lot of collagen, so, and you've cooked the sauce with the beef bones, too. So you really get a very, very velvety, silky, sweet and... Oh, so the sweet and sour part, I didn't even tell you. This is totally my grandmother, Elsie. She made sweet and sour dishes. She was from Brooklyn, but her parents were from Belarus, what we now call Belarus. Anyway, I used for that 24-ounce bottle of tomato puree and 4 pounds of neck bones, I used about 3 tablespoons of brown sugar and a half teaspoon plus a tiny pinch more of citric acid crystals, otherwise known as sour salt. And this was the souring agent that Eastern Europeans used because, of course, in those days, we're talking about into the 19th, beginning of the 20th century in Eastern Europe, a lemon, which is what we would use for as a souring agent, was a rare and expensive thing. So what you had was citric acid crystals, which, by the way, were very handy for making pickles as well. Keeps them crisp. So I, many years ago, I have to look this, it would be the early 1990s, so it's a long time ago already. I wrote a book called Soup Suppers. You remember, this is my best-selling book, Marshall.
I would imagine it would be.
It's still in print after all of these years. And people often tell me, I think even Jill has told me that it's her favorite cookbook. So I'm very proud of that. But for doing cooking classes revolving around that book, one of the things I made was my grandmother's sweet and sour cabbage soup, which is tomato-based. It has lots of tomatoes. You put it, flanken, of course. You put it in as a soup meat, meaning you just cook it along with everything else so to flavor the broth. You know, in those days, you didn't make broth and then make soup. You made soup. If you wanted to have meat flavor, you put in some meat. If you wanted to have some chicken flavor, you put in some chicken. But you didn't separately make broth. So, and certainly there was no boxed broth around. In any case, in order to do that, I bought a large quantity of sour crystals. Now, I'm afraid to say it's a lifetime supply. During that book promotion period, I gave away tons of it. Every class I would give them a packet with enough sour salt and I forget what else to make my grandmother's sweet and sour cabbage soup. And I still have a lot. So, and as you see, to make a big pot of sweet and sour gedämpte Fleisch, which gedämpte means overcooked or well cooked, depending on how you look at it and what it is. Because, like in the case of neck meat, it's hard to overcook it, but it is definitely well cooked. On the other hand, if you in a kosher home where the cook, let's not be sexist here, where the cook, usually a woman, where the cook was given the impression that she was not allowed to serve rare meat, she would make a gedempte steak, which you did not want to eat. So gedempte means, it's funny because last night I was watching an old movie, early 1950s. It's called The Seven Little Foys. I don't know if you ever saw this. It's a Bob Hope vehicle, and I must say Bob Hope is amazing. He was an amazing dancer, singer, everything amazing, I got to say. But it was very funny because it's about an Irish family, the Foys. But they were in New York. So when his agent, who's obviously Jewish and drops a few hints that he is, says to Eddie Foy, if you get that job, I'll take you out for some gedempte Brust. What does that mean? It means potted flanken. Brust flanken is a kind of, there are several cuts of flanken. Flanken, by the way, is short ribs. So, of course, short ribs are now very, very popular. So flanken has gotten very expensive. And there are other meats like that, too. So some of your used-to-be go-to inexpensive meat cuts are no longer inexpensive because they're so popular now. For instance, skirt steak. Jews used to call it Romanian tenderloin. Or skirt steak. We never called it fajitas. But when fajitas became popular, so did the price of skirt steak go up. Short ribs, the same thing. I told you, flanken is nothing but short ribs cut in the opposite direction. Hanger steak is another one. Used to be a cheap cut. If you went to a Paris bistro, really, in the old days, that's what you got. L'anglais, they called it. And my mother used to have it ground for chopped meat. So the tastes... Here's one. The biggest price increase of the last year has been on bacon. And, of course, bacon is an American comfort food. Huh. I think there's even a book called Nobody Doesn't Love Bacon. So, except unless you're kosher or Muslim and you eat halal. The biggest price increase has been on bacon. And, of course, you never could, if you bought, the breast bacon, it was always just as bacon. Now you can buy it as meat, and it's like $15 a pound. It's crazy. The fat. <That's right. laughs> Maybe there are more people on keto diet than even admit to it, because, the first thing, if I tell somebody I'm eating ketogenically, they say, oh, what do you eat, bacon all day? I mean, really, that's the impression of the low to almost no carb diet, is that all you can eat is bacon. But yes, you can eat bacon on this diet.
What a diet.
And we do.
What a diet.
Bacon and eggs. Yeah. No, bacon and eggs. So the eggs part is so cheap. The bacon, like a pound of bacon, I don't know what a whole pound of bacon costs, but maybe could be $12 or $15. I mean, I see the packages of bacon in the supermarket are $8, and then on a full pound. So there you go.
All right.
All right, become vegetarian and you can still eat for a reasonable price.
Or else just don't look at the prices and put it on
a charge account. Well, some people have to, Marshall.
I know. It's tough.
Me, it's an old habit. Yeah. I don't have to so much now. I don't have to, but that doesn't mean I'm not interested. But I do. I am, I don't want to pay $35 a pound for filet mignon, or even $24 a pound for a good steak. Unless I'm in and I will pay it in a restaurant, interestingly, because then somebody's serving me and they're cooking it at 1,000 degrees. Okay.
All right.
Time for another cup of coffee.
And bacon and some bacon.
And the price of coffee has gone up too, but not nearly as much as beef.
All right, Arthur.
Okay, take care. Everybody have a great week. It's warm this week.
All right, we'll speak to you next week, Arthur. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven here on Robin Hood Radio. Of course, you can hear Arthur every Monday morning, and we rebroadcast Arthur also on the weekends as well.
Providing support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, Hillsdale Home Chef. More information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.